I have an interesting thing here. It was actually from the Fort Myers Church that has Bible study today, but I thought I would read it to you and put your thinking caps on, see what you know here. It says, I just got this. I've been in before. I've seen it before, but now that I got it again, I thought I would double check on it. Doesn't have to be for tomorrow's Bible study, meaning today. But if you happen to know if this is true, I would like to know. All right, now. All right, here's about 19 different things that are that she is reading here and wants to know, is it true or not, in the Bible. The Garden of Eden was in Iraq. All right, what do you think? Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, was the cradle of civilization. True or false? Noah built the ark in Iraq. The Tower of Babel was in Iraq. Not sure? No? Well, if it wasn't in where? Yeah, that's true. It wasn't Iraq at that time. Abraham was from Ur, which is in southern Iraq. True or false? Well, if it's false, then where is it? I'm going to come back. I'll give you my answer to these as we go along for you to read. Isaac's wife, Rebecca, is from Nahor, which is in Iraq. Jacob met Rachel in Iraq. Jonah preached in Nineveh, which is in Iraq. Assyria, which is in Iraq, conquered the 10 tribes of Israel from Iraq. Amos cried out in Iraq. Babylon, which is in Iraq, destroyed Jerusalem. Daniel was in the lion's den in Iraq. The three Hebrew children were in the fire in Iraq. Jesus had been in Iraq also as the fourth person in the fiery furnace. Remember, there was a fourth one as the Son of Man that saved them from the fire. Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, saw the writing on the wall in Iraq. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, carried the Jews captive into Iraq. Ezekiel preached in Iraq. The wise men were from Iraq. Peter preached in Iraq. The empire of man described in Revelation is called Babylon, which was a city in Iraq. And you have probably seen this one, that Israel is the nation most often mentioned in the Bible. But did you know which nation is second? It is Iraq. However, this is not the name that is used in the Bible. The names used in the Bible are Babylon, Land of Shinar, and Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia means between the two rivers, more exactly between the Tigris and Euphrates River. The name Iraq means country with deep roots. Indeed, Iraq is a country with deep roots and is a very significant country in the Bible. No other nation except Israel has more history and prophecy associated with it than Iraq. And also, this is something to think about. Since America is typically represented by an eagle, Saddam should have read up on his Muslim messages. The following verse is from the Quran. It's interesting. Quran 9:11, chapter 9, verse 11. For it is written that a son of Arabia would awaken a fearsome eagle. The wrath of the eagle would be felt throughout the lands of Allah, and lo, while some of the people trembled in despair, still more rejoiced, for the wrath of the eagle cleansed the lands of Allah. and there was peace. So, well, actually, all 19 questions or statements I made asking is it true or false are true. They are all true. Every one of those, when you think about it. Well, where was the Tower of Babel? Well, it was in Babylon. Where's Babylon? Actually, as I said to you before, back, it's been a couple of years ago, and I know I've mentioned, made the statement, I would love to go to Iraq if I thought it was peaceful enough, and I mean, on a tour, like my wife and I toured Israel years ago, and very, very informative and very fascinating, interesting to go to all of the biblical and historical sites. I'd love to do that in Iraq. And by the way, on the Garden of Eden, the first question or so that was there, if you go to Halley's Bible Handbook and look up the first few pages under his explanations going through Genesis and the first few chapters of Genesis, very interesting archaeology work that was done in the end of the 19th century into the 20th century by, as I believe it was the British that were excavating many of those sites over there. And also, I think the Germans were involved, too. But he cites an awful lot of early archaeological discoveries of the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Iraq. And, of course, Iraq wasn't Iraq at the time that they were doing that and had the freedom to do that. And that was a country formed, was it what, after World War I, I believe it was, with the League of Nations dividing up and reforming all of the Middle East, which came out of that Jordan, Transjordan, I think it was called, and, what else, Syria. In other words, the League of Nations divided it up because you had, they were colonies or territories by that were controlled either by the, well, the Ottoman Turks, which lost in World War I, and then also the Germans had something to say about what is today Iraq. The French and the British. And I'd have to go back to reread the history and how it was all divided up, but that's when it took place, and that's when the nation of Iraq was formed. Also, I think Kuwait as well in the south. All right, I thought I would just begin with that a point of interest because, yes, that's true. All those things did take place, and the captivity of the Jewish people went to where? Iraq. What is today Iraq? Of course, it wasn't that at the time. I do have couple Bible study questions. This one is, Jesus instituted the New Testament, Passover, before his sacrifice. Since he never sinned, why did he have to observe Passover? Well, anybody have an answer for that? He was the Passover, right? If you're the Passover and you're on this earth, it would be logical that you would be observing and keeping it, and he did. And, of course, we're most familiar with the last Passover when he changed the symbols from to the unleavened bread and the wine and instituted the foot washing with it, too. Now, that reminds me of a thing that's come up here. I just heard about it here this past season. Some are trying to say, well, there was no unleavened bread at the last Passover. It was leavened bread because he dipped the sop, so he couldn't do that with leavened bread. Well, people who say that are not familiar with the different recipes of unleavened breads, different kinds. Now, the one that my wife makes that we enjoy very much and had, I think, on the night to be observed this year with people over in Fort Myers, you definitely could dip the sop with that. And yet everything in the Old Testament, where Passover is mentioned, it is onward, or any sacrifice in which it is pointing to the future coming of the Messiah of Christ, it is always, always without exception, unleavened bread. No exception. And so for people, and I can't believe this, it sort of has spread around that people, and I want to scratch my head, you know, why? I want to know what the truth is. I don't want to have some little, go off on some silly tangent, but apparently there are some who are. And what did Paul say in 1 Corinthians chapter 5? He said there in verse 8, you have leavened bread of malice and wickedness, and we are to partake of what? The unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, right? Well, who is the source of this truth? Jesus Christ. And would Jesus Christ at the Passover be then in taking, which pictures him, well, let's get back to what is the meaning of the bread itself. We all know that. The unleavened bread, of course, pictures righteousness. The leaven pictures being puffed up and arrogant, proud, full of sin. And would Jesus Christ be dipping that in the sop? And now here, Peter, James, John, take some of this. Of course not. And yet it's unbelievable, but I've heard that people feel that way. So getting back to the question, he was the Passover for one thing. And he came under the that covenant until it was time for the new one to be instituted, which he did on the final Passover of his ministry. And also, he was doing it for us. The question is, since he never sinned, why did he have to observe the Passover? Well, for one thing, it's a commandment. Wasn't he, as a Jewish lad who grew into manhood, was he not under the covenant? And to partake of the Passover? Well, certainly he was. What if he didn't? Well, then you can say, well, he's committed sin. Because they were commanded to keep. It wasn't just a suggestion. The Jewish, and prior to that, all of the Israelite tribes were commanded to keep the Passover. So, again, it would have been a disobedience on his part if he had not observed the Passover during his ministry or his life even. The second question, did Jesus also sacrifice a lamb prior to instituting the New Testament ceremony? Well, it doesn't say, but I believe he did. Not that he did, but he told in Mark 16, Mark 16:1, I guess it is where he told Peter, James, and John, I think the three of them, to go into Jerusalem and prepare for the Passover. Go to this particular house, this particular individual, add a second floor room that was just perfect for what their needs were. Now, if you're going to prepare the Passover without a lamb, what are you going to do? In John 13, verse 1, I think it is, and you can check. I may miss a verse or two or be off one or two, but I know it's right there in John 13. We went through it at the Passover. He said, and as during dinner is the way it should be translated. During dinner. Well, what are you eating? Well, lamb has always been the thing. And as I mentioned in a sermon a week or two before the Passover this year, there were 24 different sects of Jews. And we know from some of the writings of those who, of not scriptural writings, but from secular writings of the times, Philo of Alexandria and one or two others that I quoted from in that sermon, I have to go back, I can't remember now the names, that they did, some were sacrificing or killing lambs at the beginning of the 14th, which explains why it was not something unusual that Jesus and his disciples would have done that and kept the Passover on the 14th. It was not, people assume that what the Jews do today was universally done at the time of Christ. All Jews, 100%, did the same thing, and they did not. The Pharisees and the Sadducees agreed virtually on nothing. And the Sadducees were those who had been Hellenized, descendants of the Hellenization that took place during the Intertestament period of blending Greek philosophy into the Jewish religion. They didn't believe in the resurrection, as you'll recall. And several other things. When the temple was destroyed in 70 AD and burned by the Romans, that all of these sects or groups of the Pharisees, of the Jews, we never hear of again except the Pharisee group. They are the ones, and it's their really descendants that make up Orthodox Jewish religion today. You never hear of the Sadducees after the destruction, and yet they were the Acts 5 and verse 17, the high priest at the time who was in charge of the temple was a Sadducee. The Pharisees were in charge of the synagogues, or call it churches for us. And but the Sadducee party was in charge of the temple, and it was a Sadducee who was the high priest. Once the temple's gone, the Sadducees are gone after 70 AD. We never hear of them anymore in Jewish history. Then you have what's left is what the Pharisee was the more dominant and larger of the parties. It was the largest, in fact. And it is the one that continued afterwards. Probably one reason, just in, again, I can't offer evidence or proof, but I would say probably one of the reasons is because they controlled the synagogues. And whereas the Sadducees only controlled one building, the temple. And so even though the temple was burned, yet the synagogues were all over the place, weren't they? Not just in Jerusalem. And that may have a lot to do with it. Again, that's just a speculation on my part as to why their beliefs, many of the things, the traditions of the elders came really through the Pharisees, not the Sadducees. And the traditions of the elders were later recorded. They were oral at the time of Christ and later became into writing. Oh, let's see, what time? Last I remember when I saw that was close to 200 A.D. At the end of the second century, something like that. But again, I'm just trying to answer here from memory because I hadn't had a chance to really look into this question before services began. But that's the best of my understanding as far as talking about was there a lamb sacrifice. It doesn't say it specifically, but I don't know how else to... what you would conclude otherwise. Okay, let's go now to the Bible study. I'd like to get into 2 Samuel, the book of 2 Samuel today. We'd completed last time 1 Samuel. And then we took a month off during the Passover season, and a lot of things you probably have forgotten, so I'd like to come back and just review a few of the things. The reason I'm going through this, it's not so much to go through 1 and 2 Samuel, it's to go through and survey the life of King David. And that's what it's really all about, and that's the title, A Survey of David's Life, Part 5 today. The first four parts were covered principally in the book of 1 Samuel, which originally was one book, 1 and 2, along with 1 and 2 Kings. But David is an individual written more about in the Bible than anyone else as far as covering his complete life and all that he did. In the New Testament, Jesus is not written about so much as to his life and everything, but what his teachings and what it means, and as it's explained as you go throughout the New Testament writers. But David is an individual who much of prophecy centers around him. And was not written until about 200 years after his death. When Christ returns, he will what? He will come to sit upon the throne of David. And the Davidic covenant, which we'll get into next month in the Bible study, is quite interesting in itself that God made this kind of a covenant with David that there would never cease to be one to sit on the throne of David. And we'll get into the details of that at that time. But going back here, it begins really around 1 Samuel chapter 16, when Saul had deliberately turned away from God in sinning and not following the instruction that God gave him through the prophet Samuel. God told Samuel to go to Bethlehem. There is in the family of Jesse a young man. He didn't tell him a young man, but he came to see it after he got there. There was that he would anoint to be the future king of Israel and replace Saul. As it turns out, it was David who was the youngest of the boys that Samuel, he had eight sons, as I remember, eight children, seven sons, I think it was, and one daughter. And David was the youngest, the baby of the family. He's the one taking care of the sheep. His brothers were out, older ones who were 20 and above were in the army. That was the age for military service. And they were with Saul out there standing off with the Philistines in, I don't remember the location. But David was apparently around 16 years of age at the time. And the people of Bethlehem understood this anointing, the Jewish people that were in that area, as we will see even today in this study. 2 years later, or so approximately, is when that he came up to where his brothers were. His brothers were not up at the time that he was anointed. They were in the area. But around age 18 is when he came out and killed Goliath. And he was not there. He went up to take provisions to his brothers who were in the army and all of that, and to see what their needs were. And, of course, they said, what are you doing here? And, of course, they thought he was showing them up, especially the oldest brother did. Then from that period of time on, from the he was in the court of Saul because he was the hero of the country after killing Goliath for a short time, maybe no more than 2 years. And then he was, for the rest of his time until Saul died, kind of on the run and to get away from Saul. And there's a lot of interesting things about David during that time. And he is an individual who in many ways was very deeply religious and from youth on. And he was a talented individual, a very superb musician, by the way, and knew how to play. And that's how he got in well also with Saul, because he could play the lyre, L-Y-R-E, in the Bible. It was kind of a stringed instrument, and apparently he was quite good at it. And many of the psalms that he would later write, he'd put to music. He had a huge, giant choir, 4,000 membership choir, singing there in Jerusalem after he became the king. And I'd like to put them up against the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I bet they were pretty, or any other famous or large choirs today, I imagine they were pretty good. A lot of these people were quite talented in music. And even though in some ways we would look at the nation as being primitive compared to our nation today, and yet people did have some very interesting individual talents that are brought out and pointed out in the scriptures. He had a very close relationship with Saul's firstborn son, Jonathan. Jonathan, most people are not aware of, was considerably older than David. I'll just give you the scriptures rather than going back over this, because I want to get into the things here today I want to cover. In 1 Samuel 13, right after Saul became the king of Israel, 2 years after he was the king of Israel, Jonathan led an army expedition against the Philistines. Now, that tells us something right there. He had to be 20 years old, first of all, to be in the army, let alone be a commander. And, of course, being the king's son, he would be a very young commander and put in charge. The Bible tells us Saul reigned for 40 years. And what you read in 1 Samuel 13 took place in the second year of Saul's reign. So he would reign for another 38 years, and Jonathan would live for another 38 years. They both died in that battle with the Philistines 38 years later. How old was David at the time that Saul died? As you'll see today in the study, he was 30 years old. Which means that at the time that Jonathan led the expedition against the Philistines, David was not born. He had to be somewhere, that is, Jonathan was 28 to 30 years older than David. And yet a remarkable individual, Jonathan was. They had a very, very close relationship. He was willing to forsake the crown. He knew he was next in line. In fact, that was one of the things of contention that made Saul mad, that his son was willing to give it up for David. He knew David had been anointed by Samuel. And the scriptures there where it talks about that, 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 30 and 31, and 1 Samuel 23, verse 16 and 17. Now, before we go to chapter 1 here, if you want to, well, you can be turning over to 1 Samuel chapter 1, and then I'll flip back a page or so, because there's a couple things that took place just prior to the death of Samuel, and Saul and Jonathan. They died in that battle against the Philistines that opened the door for David to eventually become the king. Now, I'd like you to notice something in 1 Samuel 29. Well, 1 Samuel 28 is where Saul did not receive any answers from God through the Urim and Thummim in verse 6. So he went to the witch at Endor, a medium. And she brought up supposedly Samuel. And of course, in other words, you're going to die. You want an answer about the battles, because they were gathering armies together at Mount Gilboa. And the Israeli army was going to lose. because of the sins of Saul. Then in chapter 29, David had been for 1 year and 4 months hiding out with the Philistines. He had gone over there to get away from Saul. And Achish, one of the kings of the city-state of whichever city-state it was in the Philistines' territory, gave him the village of Ziklag, S-I-K-L-A-G, Ziklag. And so for a year and 4 months, David and his 600 soldiers and their families lived in Ziklag. Now, he had been loyal in one sense, but he lied too, because he pretended to be attacking the tribe of Judah on behalf of the Philistines. Instead, he was actually going down into the area of the Negev, of southern Israel, and attacking the Amalekites and others, and all of that. Anyhow, when the battle was about to take place here in chapter 29, it's leading up to it, David volunteered to bring his men and to help the Philistines, but the lords of the Philistines didn't trust him. They didn't want him, even though Achish, the one who he had gone to, did. But if you notice down there in chapter 29, verse 7 and 8, therefore return, he tells him, and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. And David said to Achish, but what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Now God saved him from making a very, very big mistake. What if he had been allowed to go? And after it was over with, what kind of credibility would he have had with the tribes of Israel? Because you fought against us. Another thing, too, knowing that Jonathan also died there, unless he was planning to do a number on the Philistines, it's not mentioned here. At times, David could do that, and he would be somewhat treacherous to them because they were also considered as enemies. No, this was a very good thing that he was told, we don't want you. In other words, we don't trust you. And actually, that was a very good favor. Now let's go to chapter 1. Okay, I should mention in chapter 30, before I go to chapter 1. So in chapter 30, what happens? David's heading back to Ziklag, and guess what? The Amalekites from the Negev come up from the south, and they attack and destroy Ziklag. And they take captive all of the families, the women and children that they can. They didn't kill them. They took them, either to sell them into slavery or do something. And so this occupies David while Saul and the Israelites are fighting the Philistines. And he's down there trying to retrieve their families. Okay, now we come up here to chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, and we'll move along. And this is more, I want to survey the scriptures. I don't want to read every scripture as we go along, so that we can maybe make some time here. Chapter 1, verse 1 and 2. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul that when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, after he had to go down there to retrieve the families, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, which was now in ashes, on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was that when he came to David, that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself before David. And, well, of course, David said to him, where have you come from? So he said to him, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. When we drop down here to verse 6, we begin to see a little bit about who this individual is. It's coming to bear good news to David, thinking he's going to find favor with David. A young man who told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. Now when he looked behind him, that is Saul, he saw me, and he called to me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? So I answered, I am an Amalekite. Now that should send a red flag up to David right away, because look, I just went down there and annihilated all of your cousins. for stealing our families. And you, all you Amalekites, are aligned with the Philistines. So how is it that you just happen to, like an innocent bystander, happen to come in and walk up here to Saul like that? Verse 9, so he said to me again, please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. So I stood over him, I killed him, because I was sure that that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them here to my lord, the king. Now Josephus records that what happened, Saul had fallen on his sword, as you read in the last chapter of 1 Samuel 31. He and his armor bearer fall on the sword. But Josephus points out that in falling on the sword, of course, the armor bearer died, but Saul was not yet dead from falling on the sword and was obviously going to die. And this guy comes along changing the facts a little bit and then goes ahead and finishes him off and takes the crown that he brings to David to show his evidence and proof. So he also is a person who doesn't seem to have any conscience against lying. And you find that when people came and lied to David, it did not go well for them. In fact, they would lose their life over that. But he did. And let me pull down here some of my notes I wanted to comment on. If we go down to verse 14 through 16... Now, David, I should mention here in verse 11, mourns quite a bit over the loss, and especially over the loss of Jonathan. Verse 12, and they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son. The other two sons, by the way, there were three sons that died in that battle. Jonathan's two brothers died. But there's one brother, because Saul had four sons, that was not there and he survived. And I'll come back to that in just a little bit. And the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And then David said to the young man, the Amalekite, who told him, where are you from? And he answered, I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite. And David said to him, how was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed, even though he's going to die because he's fallen on a sword? And David called one of the young men and he said, go near and execute him. And he struck him, so that he died. So David said to him, your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Well, he would have died. He should have left him alone, and he would have soon bled to death. One of the things here, hold your place here, in 1 Chronicles, if you turn over 1 Chronicles chapter 10, which is a parallel story written by Ezra, a couple hundred, well, it'd be almost 600 years later, wouldn't it? Say, when is this? Yeah, it was about, 600 years later that Chronicles was written, which was the last book of the Bible, not Malachi. The Greeks rearranged the books. But we see a little bit more given here about the situation there that took place as far as with the death of Samuel and death of Saul. 1 Chronicles chapter 10, verse 13 and 14. So Saul died for his unfaithfulness which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. Now, one of the interesting things about that, you notice he did not inquire of the Lord. And we're going to see here as we go along today, that's one thing David always does first. Before he makes any decision, before he does anything, he always inquires of the Lord. Very interesting. A young man, and he was doing that when he was being chased all over the desert by Saul and his troops trying to kill him down by the Dead Sea and all of that. For 14 years, he was most of that time on the run. Not all of it, but most of it. And every time he had to make a decision, he always inquired of the Lord. He asked for a priest who had the ephod with the Urim and Thummim. He wanted God's answer and direction. And he would not fight the Philistines. He would not go and do any of these things without, first of all, inquiring of the Lord. You'll see that time and time again. Despite all of the things later in his life, and most of the big sins that he commits are later after you have the United Kingdom. It's not in his early years. We'll talk about some of those things at a later time. Finishing the first chapter here, there is something. Verse 17 and 18, then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. Now, the book of Jasher does not exist today, but there is a fraudulent one that's been around now probably since about 17th century. There was a fellow from England, I don't know, he's an early priest or whatever, went to the Middle East in the 8th century and claimed to find a copy of the book of Jasher in Aramaic and brought it back to England. And then it was lost until about 1721. Somebody, quote, discovered it and began to have it copied. And it is apparently available. I have seen a copy of part of it, and what this I know it's a fraudulent one because it purports the one that is called the Book of Jasher today purports to tell more of the information of the Book of Genesis from the Garden of Eden through into the time of Abraham. And when you read it in comparison, which I had a chance to do once years ago up in North Carolina, it contradicts the Bible. Well, when I see that, where do I put all of my stock? I put it in the Bible. I don't put it in a book that's contradicting the Bible story. And in other words, and I had an individual up there who, frankly, left the church over that very issue and thought that the book of Jasher was more relevant than the book of Genesis. And, but so as a result, I got into some Bible encyclopedias to read about this book of Jasher at that time, and that's how I found out some of the history of this fraudulent book claiming to be that book. That's not the book that is referred to here in the scripture. There's only one other place the book of Jasher is mentioned, and that is in Joshua 10 and in verse 13. He refers to the book of Jasher as well. But if you run across anyone who says, I've got a copy of the book of Jasher here today, it is a fraudulent book. It is not, it's spurious, I'll put it that way, the same way as some of the Gnostic writings are spurious. Some, all of them, in fact, are of the Gnostic writings. song that he wrote, the Song of the Bow, a couple verses just to note here. Look at David's attitude. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. He always just speaks so highly, and Saul tried to kill him, and he could have killed Saul on two occasions down by En-Gedi. Yet he has a high regard and respect for the office. And in the case, particularly of Jonathan, of the friendship. Look at verse 26. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. And he had such a close relationship with him, and that they had a trust for one another. You'd have to go back. If you go back and read some of the scriptures in 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel 20, 1 Samuel 23, you really see how there was something there that just brought these two together. And yet, here you have Jonathan. He's 28 to 30 years his senior. And when he dies here, when Jonathan died, he would have been probably around 46 to 48 years old. And No, 58. I'm sorry, I'm off 10 years there. Had to be in his upper 50s when he died. Because it says specifically that David was 30 at the time. Let's go to chapter 2 here. In verse 1, it happened after this that David inquired of the Lord. Notice he inquires of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to any city of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. And David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to the city of Hebron. And so David looked to the Lord to know where to go. Where do I relocate? And back into the tribe of Judah. Now, he had been outside of Israel, and he had been with the Philistines up to this point. Now he's returning to Israel, and specifically to his tribe, which was Judah. And he wanted to know from the Lord, where should it be? He didn't say Bethlehem, that's where the house of Jesse's from. No, God said you go to Hebron. And doesn't say here why, but the point is that David looked to God to give him the reasons and show him. Let's drop down here to verse 6. And now may the Lord show kindness. Okay, I need to explain here. Leading up to verse 6, David was a person who wanted, when he heard that the people of Jabesh-Gilead, which were Jewish, had taken the heads that had been severed from the bodies of Jonathan and Saul, and they had buried them and showed respect to them. And so David wanted to make sure that they were not just rewarded, but treated kindly for the respect that they showed. And in verse 6, and now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you people. I also will repay you this kindness because you have done this thing. You have shown this kind of attitude and respect. And that will be taken note of, is what he is saying. You see a lot of these things, and you see why David is a man after God's own heart. He always is seeking God. He seeks the Lord. He inquires of the Lord. This is the attitude that Christ would have here for what these people did. They would not neglect it. It's interesting. Show kindness and show truth to you. I'll treat you truthfully and kindly because of what you have done. And for those who lied, like the Amalekite, they got their reward, didn't they? Going on here, and these are things you pick up, you can learn, which is why all of this is recorded for us. Verse 8 through 11. But Abner, the son of Ner, who was commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, which in 1 Chronicles is Ishbaal, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over eventually all of Israel. But it began over with the little village of Mahanaim, which would become the capital for a short time, temporary capital. Ishbosheth, or Ishbaal, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. So he was 10 years older than David, wasn't he? Upon the death, and so Abner here, is he goes with the other son of Saul, thinking he can, because he's next in line, the only son left is next in line to the throne. So the commander of his army, he's looking out for himself, to put it plain, sets up Ishbaal here to be the one. A couple things interesting about Ishbaal. If you go back here, hold your place here, and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 14, and when Saul becomes king, this is 40 years before, and 1 Samuel chapter 14, and in verse 49, here in verse 49, now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, and Jishui, I guess you'd say, and Malchishua. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the second one was Michal, who would, of course, become David's first wife. But who's missing here? This is at the beginning of his reign. So Ishbosheth must have been born in the first year, because he's not mentioned here, of Saul's reign. Saul has three sons and two daughters at the time he takes the throne. And he'll have a fourth son who will take over after he dies, because Abner sets him up, but he's not mentioned. Now, if you go over to 1 Chronicles, he is mentioned later. The chronicler, who writes hundreds of years later, does record him and calls him Ishbaal. That is, I think, the more correct name, and it's in 1 Chronicles 8. 1 Chronicles 8 and verse 33. Again, it lists the sons of Saul. You have Saul begot Jonathan, then the lists Malchishua, Abinadab, and notice Ishmael. There's, in this account, there's four. In Samuel's account, there was three sons. And again, it's repeated here in 1 Chronicles 9 and verse 39. 9:39, again, we have four sons, whereas back in Samuel's account, there was only three sons. And we can answer that by the fact that when Ishmael became the king set up by Abner, he was 40 years old. So it tells us that he obviously was born in the first year that Saul was king. Coming back now, let's take a look. I can skip through much of the rest of chapter 2 because verses 12 through 32 shows the civil war between Israel and Judah that went on off and on for almost 7 years before finally David and the tribe of Judah prevailed. One thing during these scriptures here, one of the brothers who was one of the mighty fighters, they were brothers, Joab, Abishai, and Azazel. Azazel pursued after Abner in a battle, and he would not relent and let up. Abner then killed him. And that would, of course, mean that the other two brothers, Joab and Abishai, would later seek their revenge by assassinating Abner. Abner tried not to have to fight or to kill the third brother, but the third brother, frankly, was kind of foolish in taking him on by himself, and he was killed. Let's go to chapter 3, move along here. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, but David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And Abner, of course, would begin to recognize and see that he was getting whipped on many occasions, and the tribe of Judah was becoming much stronger militarily. They were much more united, by the way, than were the other tribes at that time. Verses 2 through 5 here of chapter 3 lists all of the sons, the wives, of which at this time, before he became king of the United Kingdom, he only had two wives that are listed here. Plus, the one wife that Saul took from him and gave to another man, he would later get back, but that would not take place until he became king of the United Kingdom. So at this time, while he is in Hebron, he has his two wives. One of them there, you notice, is Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, or sometimes called Nabal the Fool. And she was still his wife. She bore him a son. These are the sons and so forth that were born to David prior to him becoming king of the United Kingdom. Now, there's another list we're going to look at later, and it's after he comes to Jerusalem. After he is king of the United Kingdom, he begins to have many wives. Up till that time, he's only got two living with him, one who would later be returned to him, his original wife. All right. Let's drop down verse 6 through 11 here of chapter 3. In verse 6, now it was so that while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. So Ishbael said to Abner, why have you gone in to my father's concubine? You've had relations with her, even though my father is dead. And Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbael and said, am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, and to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hand of David. Hint, hint, I could. And you charge me today with a fault concerning this woman? May God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the house or the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba, north to south. And he could not answer Abner in another word because he feared him. And he knew the only reason he was there was because of Abner. Now, would you say that's an admission of guilt? Notice the posturing that took place here on the part of Abner. How dare you ask such a question like that of me? I'm the one that takes care of you. You're here simply because of me. And in that sense, that's right. He was. You know, you can learn from this. You know, when somebody is confronted about something and they take a response like this. You know, he didn't say, well, that's not true. This is a big mistake. And I can explain and prove I wasn't anywhere near her. Why are you saying, you know, this is a different posture. But when somebody's coming back and trying to change the subject and trying to, in other words, putting it back on Ishmael, what do you mean asking me something like that? In other words, it's not me, it's you, Ishmael. You should never be asking me something like that. Trying to reverse it and transfer the guilt back to the other side. Human nature does that. Human nature gets it from Satan the devil, because that's what Satan does. And he certainly is not going to admit wrong. He's never wrong, is he? Satan will never repent. He's never wrong in his own eyes. Well, coming back here, I wanted to take the time to read that. It's very interesting. Now, you don't find that in the First Chronicles account about Abner doing this, but it tells us a little bit about the character of the person. Something you can learn from the examples of people's character. You might run into this sometime, and it should send up the flag immediately, the red flag, in your mind when you see people respond to a question in that manner, in that way. You know he's guilty. Absolutely. That's not the way an innocent person would respond. So now going on here in chapter 3, verses 12 through 21. rather than reading it, I'll explain a little bit. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David, saying, "Whose is the land?" Saying also, "Make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you." And David said, "Well, good, I will make a covenant with you, but one thing I require of you, that you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Now remember, Saul, after David had left Jerusalem because he had to flee, he gave Michal to this other guy in marriage. And so as you read the rest of the story down here, Abner takes her away from her husband at that time to return her to David and to cut a deal with David. And that is that I can see that I can no longer support Ishmael, and so I'm going to get behind you. Now, he's not doing this because he's concerned about the nation of Israel. He's concerned about his own hide. And making sure that he will have a prominent position. So this is all politics, isn't it, going on here on the part certainly of Abner. And David said, "Well, I can make a covenant or an agreement with you, but first I want my original wife back. I don't care if she's married to another guy or not. She belongs to me. I was given her. She was my wife." So... one interesting thing here, and wait a minute before I get ahead of myself. Let's go down to about verses 28 and 29. So they're going back and forth. Abner has come down to Hebron, and Joab and Abishai, the two brothers, were absent when Abner came down and made this agreement. And Joab is angry at David for making an agreement with Abner. And really begins to chew him out here about, where is it? Oh, let's see. Forgot. I'm trying to pick out the exact verse where where Joab lashes into David, and my eye, of course, is not hitting upon it. It mentions here in verse 28 and 29 that they killed Abner. They stuck a knife in him, and killed him. It's before that time that he's angry with David for making a... Well, here it is, verse 22. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. And when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And Joab came to the king and said, What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he has already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. In other words, you are foolish, David. And of course, what he really wants is revenge. In verse 28 and 29, he and his brother kill Abner there to get their revenge. And then in verse 32, you see David's attitude toward Abner. So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. You know, David is quite an interesting person in that regard. he respected Abner, too. He knew Abner. And he obviously knew Abner is not a perfect man. But and he knew that Abner had killed one of his three leading soldiers, which was the brother of Joab. Yet he seems to have a great deal of respect for these people and shows it there at the funerals that take place. And then he makes a statement which is interesting, showing that he does not have full control. Verse 37, for all the people and all Israel understood that David that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner the son of Ner. And then the king said to his servants, Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? Well, you know what you just read about the situation when he was questioned by Ishbael over having relations with his father's concubine. He didn't seem to be all that great of a person. He obviously is making a political move here, or he was. Verse 39, I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. And they would later die. Joab, of course, would be put to death by Solomon after David's death years into the future. So he had these two commanders of his army. Joab was commander-in-chief. And he had power. David could not just do anything to these individuals because a lot of people obviously supported them. Who were a part of his army. But they were not the kind of people you would like to have for neighbors. put it that way. Chapter 4, let's move along here. And I'll quit in time. There's a couple things I want to touch on. Verse 1 and 2. And when Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart. And all Israel was troubled. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of troops. The name of the one was Benah, whatever you say it, and the name of the other was Rechab. And the sons of Rimmon, the Berotite, the children of Benjamin, for Berotite also was part of Benjamin. Okay. All right. Let me just summarize a little bit here what's happening. Word gets back to Ishbael that his commander, Abner, is now dead. He knows that without Abner to support him, he's very, very vulnerable. So two of his captains here, of his troops, decide to assassinate him and to get in good with David and to turn the kingdom over for David to have it and be united. There isn't verse 4, kind of just something added here. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him and fled, and it happened that as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame. So his name was Mephibosheth. There's the whole chapter 9 of 2 Samuel is about this, because later on David, when he's the king of the United Kingdom, is there anybody that I can help from the house of the house of Jonathan, any descendants that he had. Yes, he had this one son. Now, either he broke a foot or ankle or did something that was probably not set correctly, and or something happened that left him in that kind of condition or shape as a young boy, and probably healed improperly as it was repairing. Okay, so there we have, we just keep in mind that Jonathan did have a son who was lame, became lame at the time of his father's death. Now, here in chapter 4, in verse 8, let's read that. And they brought the head of, the two assassins brought Ishbael's head to David at Hebron and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbael, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life, and the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and his descendants." Well, see, they expect to be rewarded. See, this is what, and now you can be fully in charge. We've taken care of your problem here for you, David. You're going to be now king of the entire kingdom. Well, David didn't go along with that too well, did he? Well, David answered Rechab and Benaiah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beratite, and so on, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity." It's God who's redeemed my life from all adversity, David says. "When someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag. And the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed, therefore shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" And then, of course, he had him executed. There's something else about this thing of Ishbosheth, the last descendant of Saul. If you hold your place here and go back to, let's see, where is it? 1 Samuel 24. When Saul was chasing David in the wilderness, here in verse 21 and 22 at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 24, "Therefore Saul, speaking to David, said, 'Swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants from me and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house.' So David swore to Saul, and Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold to get away." And that was a place where a stronghold meant a place where they could defend themselves in the wilderness from Saul's army. But notice he did swear to Saul that he would, once he became king, that he would not in any way destroy Saul's descendants. So when these two guys killed the only descendant left, that is of the males, of the sons, that also was something that David would have taken into consideration here. And these people thinking in a carnal way that I'm going to win over. No, you're not. David took their life, had them executed. In chapter 5 and verse 1, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, "You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel." Now, they're making a reference to 1 Samuel 16 and in verse 1 when Samuel came to the house of Jesse. Because the whole village, as it was then, of Bethlehem knew of this anointing. Not just the house of Jesse. And that's why they're making reference here to it. So all, verse 3, the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron, an agreement, a contract agreement before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. Now this is a physical anointing on their part. He's already been anointed spiritually by the Lord through Samuel in chapter 16 of 1 Samuel. In verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned for 33 years over all Israel and Judah together. These are important verses when it comes to chronology. And chronology and studying of this man's life or any place in the Bible is very important because I think you'll see even next month on the Davidic covenant. What's one of the interesting things is, when did God make that covenant to David, and at what point in his life? And a lot of times we assume many things. It's like many of you were surprised that Jonathan was so much older, because you always grew up thinking Jonathan and David were about the same age. No, they weren't. Jonathan could have fathered David. That's much of a spread they had in their lives. But it does show us something about the character of Jonathan as well, what type of a person he was. It reminds me of John the Baptist and Jesus Christ, that I must decline, you must increase. I think close to that. He understood that the time of his ministry was coming to an end, and that Christ's ministry, who was his cousin physically, was to increase. Well, Jonathan had to step aside. Had he not died, there would have been a problem, wouldn't there? There would have been a big problem, because he was the firstborn of Saul. And so God allowed it for him to die in the battle, as well as Saul and the other two brothers. Winston Churchill once said, "There's a, to U.S. Congress, there is a what a invisible hand here working," or words to that effect. Forgot how that goes, but that's true. God does have a hand in many things that take place. At the time, people don't always see it, but looking back, they recognize that's not just time and chance that's taking place. There is a purpose. There's a reason for the way some things happen. Here in going on in chapter 5, verses 6 and now through 9, and the king and his men, after he comes to Jerusalem. Now, when is this? He's 37 years old, right? 37 and a half years old. He comes to Jerusalem. The king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, which were a tribe of the Canaanites, and the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David, saying, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you," thinking David cannot come in here. Now, that's not clear in the King James or even in the New King James, but in any other modern translation, it will be cleared up. Simply, they were boasting from the walls of Jerusalem and the stronghold of Zion, as it would be later called, or it was even called that at the time, that, look, even the blind and lame can't come in here. Who do you think you are, David? You're not going to take it. It's interesting. Why did David want Jerusalem? For 350 years from the time that they had come into the Promised Land, the Israelites could never conquer Jerusalem. They conquered the village north of Jerusalem, you'll find in Joshua, and they burned it. But the stronghold of Zion, the citadel, they never could take it. And the Jebusites controlled it, and they actually mocked David and his men. And David knew that it has to be an inside job. So verse 7, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold," or, well, wait a minute, in verse 6, last half, "You shall not come in," well, excuse me, again, verse 7, "Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is today called the city of David. David said, 'On that day, whoever climbs up by the way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul." In other words, he took note of what they were making fun of him. Therefore, they say, "The blind and the lame shall not come into the house." They did. David knew something. Either his spies had told him, or when you're in Jerusalem, the pool of Gihon is the only source of water to the ancient city, but it's outside the walls. Now, what is called archaeologically Warren's Shaft, which was discovered, I don't know, more than 100 years ago, I think more than 100 years ago, is a shaft there that appears to go down to that well, or to the source of the water of that well inside. And it's always been speculated, I think it's pretty certain now, that Joab and his men climbed up through the shaft, which, of course, was from the outside into the inside, and were able to get inside to open up the, I don't know if they opened the gates or what, but got inside so that they could win the battle and take it. And so it became the stronghold of Zion. It became also known as the city of David. Verse 13, and it also became the capital. You know, up to this time, Israel did not control it. Saul's capital was up north at Ramah, and then Abner had Mahanaim for a short time, temporary time. Now here we have Jerusalem become the permanent capital of Israel. very interesting. Let me just digress a moment, if I can, with you. President Obama talked about in Israel giving back, modern Israel giving back, going back to the 67 borders. And another thing he brought up was one of the first things in negotiating with the Palestinians is to the city of Jerusalem. And that has probably, that's always been last on the agenda before, because it would be the most stickling thing of all. You have to wonder, because you know there's going to be an abomination of desolation. Something's going to be built by the Jews up there. There are going to be evening and morning sacrifices. Why? Because Christ said so. And right now it looks totally impossible politically and socially that that could happen. You have to wonder, when somebody as a president who has influence and so forth starts talking about negotiating a peace treaty with the Palestinians that both sides can agree to, is that going to push into where the Jews can have an equal opportunity on the Temple Mount? Anyhow, just a thought, so keep it in mind. You never know how prophecy will come about. We know that, as the Bible says, at the appointed time, which is when? God only knows, right? But we are to watch these events, and maybe, who knows? I don't know how. I couldn't tell you how it's going to come out. But we should always pay attention to what is going on, because maybe that will lead into something someday. I don't know. Now, if we drop down to verse 13 and 14, and David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem, and after he had come to Hebron, also more sons and daughters. And these are the names of them, and I'll let you read them. These are the additions to what was given back in chapter 3. In chapter 3, those are the ones he had when he was in Hebron. Now when he comes to Jerusalem, more will be added. And it is also mentioned in 1 Chronicles chapter 14 and verses 3 through 7. David's wives and sons that he had in Jerusalem. In verse 17 through 19, now when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. And David heard of it. He went down to the stronghold. The Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. The valley of the giants is what that means. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, notice, David inquires of the Lord, shall I go up against them? And the answer was, yes, and you will win. And he did. Well, the Philistines weren't done. They got licked in that battle. They decided to reassemble and come back. So, verse 22, the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim in the same place. And when David inquired of the Lord, again, I'm not going down until I've inquired of the Lord. And the Lord told him, you shall not go up, but rather circle around behind them and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees. Ambush them. Hit them from behind. Because they are reinforced and they're ready for a frontal assault, but not from the rear. And so God had, David had God on his side. And when he would inquire, God would answer. And through the priest or whoever had the ephod to tell him, giving him the answer what to do. Now let's go to chapter 6. You look at all the times David has inquired of the Lord for everything of any consequence at all. A great lesson for all of us. And the couple times, which will be in later Bible studies, that he did not inquire of the Lord, he got into big trouble. And we'll see that at later times. Let me finish here and go quickly through chapter 6. In chapter 6, verse 1 through 4. Again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000 men, and David arose and he went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, whose name is called by the name the Lord of Hosts that dwells between the cherubim. Now, let me give you some background to this. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, in verses 20 and 21, and again in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel, verse 1 and 2. What happened was that when they went to bring the ark up at the time after defeating or getting it back from the Philistines, they didn't have a place to put it. So for 20 years, it stayed in this individual's home. I think he's mentioned here, Abinadab, the sons of Abinadab, for 20 years. 20 years. Now David has taken Jerusalem and he wants to bring it. David knows where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. Jerusalem, Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount today. He knew that because he tells us in Psalm 110 about Melchizedek. And so he knew more than what's being recorded here in 2 Samuel, showing us the reasons why he wanted to take it from the Jebusites. This was the place, he was certain, where God was going to place his name. And that was indeed the case. Now, so after 20 years, it's to come here, and he built, the temple's not built yet, is it? Solomon builds the temple. But he does build a tabernacle in Jerusalem and what would later be around the Temple Mount area. And there is where the ark would be placed until the temple would later be built by Solomon. So it's brought up, but it's in a tabernacle, a tent, in other words, we would call it today. Now, if something happens that raises questions on the way as they're bringing it up. Verse 5, then David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord and all kinds of instruments made of fir wood, harps, stringed instruments, tambourines, cisterns, and cymbals, and so on. Notice that these people have quite a number of different instruments and musical things, and they obviously made notes and knew how to play them. And when they came to Nashon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen were stumbling, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. And David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah, excuse me, to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? Well, let's stop, because always the question is, why did God kill Uzzah? He did. He was simply trying to do the job. He was simply trying to protect the ark. He seems to be a very innocent individual. Why would he have done this? Well, several things we should look at. Let's go over here to 1 Chronicles account. 1 Chronicles chapter 1 Chronicles 13. 1 Chronicles 13, and in verse 10. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and he struck him because he put his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. Okay, this is the account here given by, actually it's Ezra later on. Now if we go to chapter 15 of 1 Chronicles, verse 2, this is later now. Then David said, no one may carry the ark of God but the Levites, for the Lord has chosen them to carry the ark of God and to minister before him forever. Now, the interesting thing about this is David was angry, we already read, when this happened, and upset that Uzzah died. He did not understand it, did he? Well, a lot of people don't understand certain things that happen. Why does God let this happen? Why does God allow that? At the time, we don't know. David didn't know either, did he? Now, later, David is beginning to understand. Beginning to understand. Let's notice verses 12 through 16 here, dropping down. Then he said to them, you are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites. Sanctify, set apart yourselves, you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel to the place I have prepared for you, or for it. For because you did so, did not do it the first time. In other words, you didn't prepare yourselves to bring the ark up at the time I wanted to bring it up, as you should have. The Lord our God broke out against us because we did not consult him about the proper order. Notice that? A mistake he did not inquire of the Lord. Had he done that, what would have happened? The Lord would have said, the Levites bring it up. And we'll see that from the book of Numbers. Verse 14, so the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel. And the children of the Levites bore the ark of God on their shoulders by its poles as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. Then David spoke to the leaders of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be the singers accompanied by instruments of music, stringed instruments, harps, cymbals, by raising the voice with resounding joy. You know, if you recall back there when Uzzah died, who was doing all the singing and celebrating? David without the Levites. The Levites also were to be involved in the singing, celebrating with the instruments. They were left out. Now, hold your, going back here, let's go to the book of Numbers chapter 4 and in verse 5. Numbers 4 and in verse 5. When the camp prepares to journey, Aaron and his sons shall come, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. They are the ones who will transport it and move it. And there is a precise way, if you want to read on there, of how they were to do it. So that explained it. Now, David had to take time to pray, to meditate, and go back and read the scriptures. The kings were to read the books of the law, weren't they? And he began to see when he got back to the book of Numbers, you Levites did not prepare yourselves. And of course, David should have inquired of the Lord himself about how to bring it up. He was anxious and celebrating and all of that and overlooked something that was very important to do there. Now, let me finish the book of chapter 6 and we'll quit right there. There's a couple things I want to mention to you. verse 16, now when they're finally bringing it back, correctly, and as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, which is now Jerusalem and Mount Zion, Michal, David's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord in celebration, and she despised him in her heart. And so they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had erected for it, and then David offered burnt offerings, peace offerings, and so on. So she despised him, and it didn't end there. She saw him out the window. His robes were kind of falling and coming apart, and you could see his legs and all the way up his thighs and everything. But he was doing it in honor and to God who was giving and bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. Well, in verse 20, then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. Well, that didn't set too well, did it? And David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, people of the Lord over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord. And I will be even more undignified than this, and will be humble in my own sight. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor. Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. And he provided for her, but apparently never had any relations with her after that. It was not just disrespect of his office, but for what he was doing before the Lord. That was very important to David. One other thing I'll just mention here in closing. In verse 19, they celebrated. He gave out a loaf of bread, piece of meat, and cakes of raisins to all the citizens, which was very generous for that day and for the supplies they had available to them. In 1 Chronicles chapter 16, I won't turn to it, but the latter half of it, verses 7 through 36, you have David's song or psalm that he wrote in bringing this up. It is Psalm 105. And it is, so if you read Psalm 105 or 1 Chronicles 16, it was that which he gave in his singing and music and put to music in his thanksgiving and appreciation to God for returning the ark and bringing it here to Jerusalem. Well, next time, chapter 7, we get into the Davidic covenant. And there's a lot of things in relation to prophecy to that that I'd like to talk about. And so we'll stop here and resume here in chapter 7 next month.